Americans for the Arts.
I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Midpoint Friday. I'm your host, Janelle Irwin, local government and politics reporter for Florida Politics. Frank Knox is, as always, our faithful engineer, and Patty Perkey is wrangling the phones. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Today is the 21st day of the partial government shutdown as the stalemate between congressional Democrats and President Donald Trump rages on. It's also the first day furloughed federal workers won't be receiving their full paychecks. That's affecting about 800,000 Americans. The longer the shutdown continues, the more it affects non-government workers. People on food stamps are inching closer to February when funds for nutrition services won't be available. And about 1,000 contracts under the Housing and Urban Development Department aren't being extended, meaning low-income citizens using federal assistance for housing risk being evicted if their landlords stop receiving payments on their behalf. TSA workers, of course, at airports are continuing sick outs over missed pay, threatening safety at American airports, and the list goes on. As a result, of course, President Donald Trump addressed the nation live this week from the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. Networks aired the 8-minute address and a response from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Airing Trump's address was quite the controversy. Many thought networks should decline his request for live primetime air because the president has built a reputation for sharing falsehoods and mistruths. We'll be joined by Al Tompkins from the Poynter Institute to discuss the media's obligation to cover a president and the new questions that arise in the Trump era about giving him both ink and presence on the airwaves. But first, we'll be talking about Hillsborough County's new transportation and transit tax. We'll be taking your comments and questions in just a few minutes. Give us a call with those at 813-239-9663. Or send them to dj@wmnf.org. You can also text us at 813-433-0885. We are joined in studio by All for Transportation campaign volunteer Christina Barker. All for Transportation is the citizen-led group that successfully gathered more than 70,000 petitions to put the 1% sales, 1% transportation and transit sales tax referendum on the November ballot. That measure passed with 57% of the vote. It'll raise about $300 million annually for both transportation and transit enhancements throughout Hillsborough County. Spending priorities for the money include both road and safety projects, including traffic congestion reduction, as well as transit enhancements. But the fate of the voter-approved tax is uncertain after Hillsborough County Commissioner Stacey White filed a lawsuit to overturn it. A decision in that case is not expected until May. Christina, here to talk about it. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And, you know, understanding that you're limited in what you can say as it relates to the lawsuit, because the campaign, of course, has joined as an intervener in that case to defend it. Just talk to us a little bit about what's happening and what we might expect.
You know, I think that we're really excited to see that the overwhelming support for our plan in November. I think it was a real message to elected officials that people in Hillsborough County want to see transportation improvements. And so what we're looking at right now is how do we start implementing those improvements, spending those funds to get to those priorities, to have safer streets, to reduce congestion, and to give people options to get to and from work and wherever they need to go without necessarily having to get in a car.
So now this is called into question because of the lawsuit. Again, I know that you're restricted in what you can and can't say about the pending litigation. But what are the threats, and should people who voted for this be worried?
We feel very confident about our amendment. We feel very confident that the voters supported the full plan with, you know, all of the priorities that were set and with the oversight committee. And we think that at this point, you know, we should be moving forward and implementing those solutions. And we're disappointed in any halt in implementing or moving forward, but we think that we're going to see things start to happen after May, and even before then, we're seeing the county commission, we're seeing the oversight committee getting put together, and so we are seeing movement. A lot of transportation projects are big projects that take a long time, but a lot of things in this plan were pretty easy to get done: sidewalks, crosswalks, safety measures, and so we're looking forward to seeing those things start to pop up in neighborhoods across Hillsborough County.
And now the revenue from this would not have started rolling in until about March anyways, because as I understand it from the clerk of the court's office. I had to think about which constitutional office it was. From the clerk of the court's office, you know, the tax collected by retailers gets remitted to the Department of State. Is it the Department of Revenue?
It gets
Listen to me. I'm just all over the place.
They send it to the state. I'm not exactly sure which department.
And then the state sends it back to
That's
the clerk's
right.
office.
That's
and then
right.
it's their duty to distribute it. The question now becomes, because of this lawsuit, is once they start receiving that money from the state, are they able to start distributing it to the agencies that receive it? And the answer that I've gotten thus far from the clerk's office is, we're not sure yet. So nobody's really sure yet. So that's kind of what's up in the air. And I know that there's been already some impacts in terms of delays. The Hillsborough Area Regional Transit Authority is, they delayed moving forward with purchasing at least 30 new electric buses.
Yeah.
The county is now considering kind of fronting them $10 million so they can get at least 8 to get the ball rolling, but that's up in the air too. What else are we seeing?
Well, first, I think that, you know, we have some really great leadership at HART. Jeff Seward, the interim CEO, Les Miller, the current chair, you know, they really took some steps once the referendum was successful to ensure that people would start getting service as quickly as possible. Buses are not quick to purchase. It takes a year and a half, 2 years to get a new bus operating on a street after you purchase it. So they had, you know, other solutions, fixes where they could get buses from across the state. They could get service on the road in a matter of months. And we were really supportive of making those moves to make sure people understood that they're making this investment and they're going to see improvements. Unfortunately, it has been stalled because of the lawsuit. But I think that what is really important to focus on there is just that the HART board is showing some real leadership. And while, you know, this is something that they couldn't have expected, I think that once it's resolved, you're going to see them go back to that quick action and really implementing the will of the voters.
I want to get into some of the details and especially the can and cannots with
sure.
this additional revenue in just a minute. But I just want to point out a few details for our listeners before we start answering questions and diving into those. If you have a question about what this tax means and how the money can be spent, give us a call, because Christina is kind of the expert on the charter around these parts. The number to call is 813-239-9663. You can text your messages to 813-433-0885, or you can email them to dj@wmnf.org. And I'll throw out one more if you're out there on the Twitter sphere. You can also send, tweet me your questions. I am at Janelle Irwin FL. So real quick, HART is looking for a new CEO. So this lawsuit has thrown a little bit of a monkey wrench into that process, just in terms of delays and such. And now just yesterday, I reported about the Tampa Bay Partnership stepping in and saying, in light of this referendum that was passed and the additional revenue that it's going to mean for HART, and just to put that into perspective, HART's annual operating budget right now is about $80 million. With this revenue, that's going to just balloon to about $200 million. So that is huge. It's going to make them, you know, go from one of the worst funded transit agencies in the nation to kind of middle of the pack. No,
yeah, it goes I think they were at about 90 in the 90s of best funded transit systems, which is very low, and then they went to somewhere in the 40s overnight. So it's a huge investment.
Yeah,
it's a whole new day for them.
That is crazy. So the Tampa Bay Partnership is saying, you know, okay, HART, you've got four people that you're putting forward for a new CEO. All four of those candidates, they think, lack the qualifications and experience necessary to do what HART is going to be able to do with this additional revenue. One of the candidates is internal, so she's vying for a promotion, as one does. And then the other three are either from smaller agencies or they're not coming from CEO type roles. So that's going on.
And I think that, you know, voters have made an unprecedented investment in HART. And so we really do, it is key that we recruit the absolute best leader that can bring best practices to Tampa, to Hillsborough County, implement those practices, build up a really strong team. And I think that the Hart Board is going to find the perfect fit. So, you know, while a lot of the candidates on paper, you know, they may have a really great vision for what Hillsborough County is. And we want to hear from as many of those candidates as possible. I think there are some strong candidates on the list. And I think that if Hart is not comfortable where they land, I don't think that they will settle for anything less than what Hillsborough County deserves.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, let's just be blunt. Traffic in Hillsborough County and throughout the Tampa Bay region, it sucks. I drive over here every Friday and oftentimes several other days throughout the week from my home in Seminole.
We didn't hear anyone on the campaign trail saying that they loved the traffic.
I know. Yeah. Like, there is nothing fun about turning the Howard Franklin Bridge into a parking lot at rush hour or anytime somebody has a fender bender and everybody feels like they need to crane their head to take a peek because, I don't know, somebody might have gotten into a crash and suddenly lost their clothes.
Unbelievable.
Like, why do people feel like they have to look? Is that what they're thinking? So how does this referendum help to solve these transportation problems, reduce congestion? And the bigger question might even be, how the hell were you guys successful when everybody else going back to 2010 and even before that has been unsuccessful?
Thanks. Yeah. It was not an easy mountain to climb. You know, when we started collecting petitions, I think that we were met with a lot of folks who said, these things don't win. It doesn't matter. They don't win. But we were the benefit of I think, good timing, first of all. I think having a plan that was better than the other plans that have been given to voters, our plan was balanced. It had something in it for every neighborhood. It was constructed in a way that was going to promote fairness among the neighborhoods. And, you know, as well as the fact that we had a bottom-up approach. You know, we took it to people, we asked them to put their name to join us in asking voters to make this investment. We had the support of the business community. Those two pillars of our campaign were key, and getting all of them on the same page, the grassroots and the business community, while promoting a really good plan, I think is what made us successful.
Awesome. It helps to turn my microphone on. You can't hear me if I don't do that. So one of the things that I found particularly amazing, and hats off to you and the entire campaign for making this happen, there were places. So my children laughed at me. I sat at the coffee table in my house and I took a map of the county with the precincts mm-hmm. outlined, and I colored in precinct by precinct, either I think I used pink and blue because I didn't have red and green, which precincts voted overwhelmingly or not overwhelmingly, more than half in favor and which ones voted against. And
coloring can be very stress relieving, I found.
It totally was. I'm not going to lie. And I got the added bonus of being like, guys, mommy's working.
Yes, that's right.
Like, but no, mommy, you're coloring. I'm like, but it's work.
So living the dream.
Living the dream. And of course I had a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Duh.
Yeah.
So anyways, when you looked at that map, once I had it all colored, and it wasn't really that pretty.
Yeah.
I don't know, like a 10-year-old could stay in the lines better. There were places compared to the 2010 referendum that failed that switched.
Yeah.
They had voted against it, and now suddenly they were voting against it. And these were places that were around Brandon, around Riverview. Plant City was huge. Like,
yeah.
All of Plant City was like, hooray, referendum. We are happy to tax ourselves because, again, traffic sucks.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
You know, again, it goes back to the plan, right? I mean, Plant City, for instance, they receive absolutely no transit service. They have traffic problems. Our county has grown by, you know, tens of thousands of residents since the last time voters got the opportunity to make an investment in transportation. And I think that our message just really resonated with people. We tapped into that frustration that they were not being given solutions to this problem. There was so much talk, so many plans, so many studies, and we presented them with a solution. The solution is funding. the solution is you need to make the investment to get back those improvements that are going to improve your quality of life. And we went to every corner of this county and we heard from people who couldn't get to work on the bus, or the bus route had been cut, and businesses that lost employees, and people who were constantly late to pick up their kids because they were sitting in traffic. It's something that affects everyone's day-to-day life. And when you offer them a common sense solution that has parameters, that has priorities, that mean something to them, I think that is why that they stood up and they said, yeah, you know what? This is a plan that's going to work for my neighborhood.
So talk to me about some of the criticism that the campaign faced. One of those was that the referendum, the new charter, that since it's now been approved, doesn't allow for road widening, which a lot of folks think that if you add capacity, it helps reduce traffic congestion. There are, of course, plenty of people who disagree with that premise as well.
Right.
And scientific studies. What? Did somebody say something? So what does it allow in terms of roads, and what doesn't it allow?
Yeah. So first, I think that there's ways you add capacity to roads that don't necessarily mean more asphalt, right? So having traffic lights that are timed right, advanced traffic management systems, that's going to make your roads more efficient. It's going to reduce congestion. Having less accidents on your roads is going to make them more efficient. But another way is definitely there are some places in the county that need more lanes on roads and need new roads. And so what we had in the amendment were a set of priorities. Road widening would have fallen in to the 20% that the cities and county get just as flexible spending. They can spend all that money on road widening if they so choose and if it's needed. We also limited it we didn't say no road widening. That is a complete myth that the plan does not have money for road widening. It has the potential to have over $1 billion more for road widening with the referendum being successful than with not. But we limited in other areas because we did want to set those priorities out. And frankly, the county has spent quite a bit of money widening and giving new roads. They have an $800 million that they've put aside in new revenue, and a lot of that is slated for road projects. And they're going to be able to make those road projects better and safer now that they have this additional revenue.
So if you are just tuning in to WMNF's Midpoint Friday, I'm Janelle Irwin, and I'm joined with Christina Barker. She is one of the many very talented campaign volunteers for the group All for Transportation that was behind the transportation and transit tax referendum that passed in November. And we are talking about what that does, what it means for traffic, what it means for transit connections all throughout Hillsborough County. If you have a question or a comment, please give us a call, 813-239-9663. We'll be on this topic for about another 6.5-7 minutes. You can also send us a text message to 813-433-0885, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. Speaking of emails, we have a question from a listener who wants to know if this referendum is something that is looking at more buses or if it's potentially a more advanced transportation system. I assume he means other modalities. I correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is that the beauty of the referendum is that it doesn't stipulate what it has to be.
That's right. So there is a portion of HART's money. HART gets 45% of the total penny. And as you said, that is more than doubling their budget. But of that money, part of it does say that it needs to go to expanding the bus service. Buses are the current mode that we currently have. They're not running as frequently or reaching as many places as we need them to. So we did in the amendment say that some of this initially has to go to bus expansion. But they also have 35% that they have to spend on some sort of dedicated right-of-way service. So that means service that for at least 75% of the total service is operating in its own guideway, in its own lane, not in mixed traffic. What that mode ends up being, if it ends up being BRT, extending and modernizing the streetcar, commuter rail and the CSX lines, those decisions haven't been made yet. We didn't feel like it was appropriate for us to tell the community what the mode choice was. That's going to have to be a larger community conversation. It's going to have to take a lot of work between HART and the county and the cities to get on the same page about that. We obviously felt, though, that in making sure that there were new options added was really important. And so that's why we put some of that into its own bucket. And that does follow, you know, the MPO's long-term transportation plan that we've always envisioned having new modes in Hillsborough County, and now we have the funding to do it.
Let's take some questions or comments from some callers. Chip in Tampa, you are on the air. What would you like to say today?
Well, I'd like to say, first of all, Janelle, I'm glad you're back on. It's nice to have a true progressive hosting this show.
Eek, uh-huh. Eek, don't say that. I'm not supposed to have labels.
Well.
Thank you, though.
Okay. and, you know, I know people of all walks got behind this tax, and especially progressives, but I think people have been duped. And first of all, there was a lot of money behind this campaign, and a lot of big money. And by big money, I mean, money that came from wealthy sources. And that should raise a red flag in everyone. Anytime a candidate or an issue has big organized money behind it, that's raise a red flag. You should ask why. And the plan itself, I don't have a big problem with, but it's the funding. And, you know, if I'm a developer, I would have gotten behind this plan and done all I could to support it, because nothing encourages more growth than lowering congestion. And I think what we're doing is giving a pass to all the politicians in the past who allowed the growth that didn't pay for improved transportation, and the same logic applies to the school tax. All the politicians that allowed it, and all the developers and real estate people who benefited the growth in the past 30 years, which has been rampant, if we use the increased revenue from all that growth wisely, we wouldn't have such problems on our roads and in our schools.
So, Chip, great points. Thank you so much. We hear you, and we're going to address that right now, so stay tuned. That was another common thing. Your employer, Jeff Bennick,
right,
was a huge contributor to the All for Transportation campaign. Sports teams donated. There was a lot of deep pockets involved in this. I think what Chip is saying resonates with a lot of Hillsborough County residents. I know you and I have had this conversation before, and it's a line of reasoning that irks you a little bit because you're so close to the issue. How do you defend against that?
Yeah, you know, getting your message out to a county that is as large and diverse as Hillsborough County is not easy, and we would not have been able to do it without resources. And I understand the skepticism that big money brings to the table, but our big donors, Frank Morisani, Jeff Vinnick, Chuck Sykes, the sports teams, they have a real vested stake in this community, and they care about their community. And while transportation is a good business decision, it's also something that provides equity to neighborhoods. It's also something that gives people the freedom, you know, to spend their money on other things besides a car. And so I think that the business community support was critical to our success, and it was paired with that grassroots support. It's really hard to get those two things on the same page. And we were able to do that because we had a plan that was beneficial for everyone. So I think that some of the criticism around our contributions to the campaign is understood, but I do feel that the folks who contributed to our campaign are great community leaders who wanted to see what was best.
Awesome. Well, we are coming up on a break here, but I want to take one more call really quick. Dan in Tampa, you're on the air. What's your comment or question?
Hi. What does this money do with fixing up Malfunction Junction and bringing a mass transit down to the intermodal at Charlie's Steakhouse?
Well, a lot of Malfunction Junction, because that's the highway, that falls on the Florida Department of Transportation. But I'm going to let Christina take it away with the potential fixes in terms of transit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so none of this money can be spent on our highways. That is something that's excluded. It's a local funding source for our local systems. But what it can do for transit, you know, any proposed multimodal station, whether you're talking about the one on West Shore or downtown, is going to need to have services that actually connect in them. A multimodal station without any multiple modes is really not useful to anybody. So what this does is it gives our community the opportunity to get that service up and running. And by the time we see those multimodal centers getting built, hopefully we'll have the service there and the ridership, and it'll be more of a success because we have better transit options.
All right. Well, with that, I'm going to call it. We are at the tail end of the first half of our show today. If you're tuning in to WMNF's Midpoint Friday, I'm Janelle Irwin. We've been joined by Christina Barker from the All for Transportation campaign, talking all things transportation and transit in Hillsborough County. We are going to come back from this break here in just a couple minutes and speak with Al Tomkin about a lot of the issues surrounding President Donald Trump, Congress, the border wall, and the 21st day and counting of the partial government shutdown. So please stay tuned. It is bound to be an interesting conversation. If you'd like to go ahead and get in on the queue for that conversation, the number to call is 813-239-9663. Thank you so much, Christina, for joining us and for clearing up some questions about this very important issue. We really appreciate having you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, great. And I just want to say that support for WMNF comes from our members and Happy Feet Plus, a locally owned and full-service footwear store featuring Birkenstock, Kenko, massage sandals, and many other name brands. Happy Feet Plus offers footwear fashion to provide relief to people with foot, leg, knee, and back pain. Styles and selections at happyfeet.com.
So I left my job about 5 o'clock, 15 minutes to go 3 blocks, just in time to stand in line, the freeway looking like a parking lot.
Damn, this sunny day. How I hate to be late. Hurts my motor to go so-so. Time to get home, myself will be cold. Damn, this traffic jam.
So I almost had a heart attack. Looking in the rearview mirror, saw myself the next car back. Looking in the rearview mirror, about to have a heart attack. I said,
damn, this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. Hurts my motor to go so-so. Time to get home, myself will be cold. Damn, this traffic jam.
I don't want no coffin. Thought about it all too often. Just strap me in behind the wheel. Bury me with my automobile.
Damn, this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. Hurts my motor to go so-so. Damn, this traffic jam. Time to get home, nice of a vehicle. Damn, this traffic jam.
All right. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Midpoint Friday. I am Janelle Irwin, local government and politics reporter for Florida Politics. And if you have been joining us for the whole show, thank you very much. We are shifting gears now from Hillsborough County's transportation tax and the lawsuit challenging it to a major national issue. The U.S. is now on day 21 of the partial government shutdown, spurred by the standoff between congressional Democrats and President Donald Trump over his $5.7 billion border wall ask. That also includes humanitarian aid at the U.S.-Mexico border. It's a shutdown that seems to have no end in sight, and Trump himself has said he's prepared to let it wage on for months or even years if Democrats don't work with him on funding for the wall. The issue prompted Trump to deliver an 8-minute presidential address from the Oval Office earlier this week. Controversy immediately sparked over whether television networks should grant him this live primetime slot. We'll be taking your comments and questions in just a few moments. The number to call is 813-239-9663, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. But first, joining us today by phone to talk about the media's responsibility to cover the president and addresses like these is Al Tomkins, veteran journalist, author, and teacher at the Poynter Institute. Al, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hiya, Janelle. How are you?
I am great. So good to hear your voice. You're always so jovial and Fred, like you just make me want to smile. You could probably say something really mean and I'd be like, oh.
Man, you got to laugh about stuff right now. We need it, don't we?
You ain't kidding, boy. All right. So let's dig right in because I went a little over on my first topic there. So you argued in a post on the Poynter Institute's website prior to Trump's address that networks were right to air his address. After all, he is the president and there's a major national crisis happening with the shutdown. He threatened to possibly declare an emergency. These are all things worthy of a primetime address. Talk about that.
Well, look, whether put aside whatever it is you think about the president of the United States, the fact is it's the president. And when the president of the United States makes a request to make an Oval Office speech in prime time, you take it seriously. And add on top of that the fact that we are so deep into this partial government shutdown, 800,000 people currently out of work, plus all the ripple effect of that. On top of that, a spending bill that would involve billions of dollars and affect, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people on the border. I mean, all of these things together create a witch's brew that you have to say this is a significant issue that goes well beyond politics, and we take that seriously. And so, on top of that, there was at the moment, if you'll rewind back to Monday, there was at the moment a suspicion that he might declare an emergency, a crisis, and attempt to fund the wall using crisis money. And that continued all the way up until the address ended on Tuesday. So all of that together added up to what I thought was a relatively clear-cut decision that, you bet, you put the airtime out there and you let the president say what the president's going to say, because so much depends on what the president of the United States says at any given time. I think the president squandered the opportunity, said nothing new. The Democrats said nothing new. And in the end, none of it was worthy of primetime coverage. But
so that you're getting to my second question already. So this kind of just shows that you are a more senior journalist and probably a better interviewer than I am. Because there was no news, and you tweeted that, and I retweeted you. Does it kind of make the networks feel bamboozled? Like, should they reconsider how they decide whether or not to give this particular president that same consideration for that coveted airtime?
Well, I think there's two questions there. One, do they feel bamboozled? And the answer I would say is probably not, because it wasn't their fault that the president didn't take advantage of this opportunity and that they used it for such a low bar announcement. It's not the network's fault. It's the fault of the request and the requesters, if there is such a word. And the networks did what I think they should have done. They acted in good faith. They tried to be good citizens. And by the way, the viewership was pretty high.
Yeah.
if you believe the overnights, and I don't always, but, you know, the viewership was pretty high. I think the number was 40 million is what I heard, combining all media, including cable.
Yeah, I think that's what I remember seeing. And then I also remember seeing a statistic about the percentage of those who tuned in and didn't.
I don't know how much I believe that. We could have another whole conversation sometime about overnight ratings.
You never know when these little tidbits are manufactured.
And you also don't know. Remember, it's a big country. And so 9 o'clock Eastern time, 6 o'clock on the California coast, lots of stuff's going on. Tune-in times are different on the West Coast. There's a lot going on, but it's enough to say that 40 million viewers is a lot of viewers, and people are intensely interested in this subject for obvious reasons. It involves not just public policy, but also real money and real economic factors and real questions of safety and all kinds of things. So it's a legitimate topic. But what I would say is the networks had no choice, and it won't surprise me and shouldn't surprise anybody that if the president of the United States were to ask for primetime access in the future, the networks would be right, and understandably so, to say, we got to know more. We got to know what we're talking about here before we're going to give that kind of money away. And it is money, because they're shifting advertising out of a primetime spot and into a later hour, which will require fewer dollars in ads. It's disruptive to their schedule, is disruptive to their economics. It's not so hugely disruptive it can't be made up. And let's face it, the television stations are licensed to serve the community, and it's their civic obligation.
So one of the things that I've heard from people criticizing networks for broadcasting this, was that when there was a time when President Barack Obama also asked for a primetime address, and it was denied. And I think you actually wrote this in one of your posts. What they're losing is that was the Obama would have been speech was during sweeps.
Well, let's remind people what sweeps are.
Yes, good call.
February, May, July, and November are periods when the Nielsen Rating Company, which is over in Bradenton, by the way, Nielsen does ratings in those months. But now they do ratings every day, so the sweeps months are less important than they used to be, but they're not unimportant. They are pretty important. And advertisers use the numbers that come from those sweep months to determine how much they're going to pay for advertising. As I say now, though, ratings are produced overnight every day now. But during those days, the Obama administration asked for primetime access. Everybody said, what are you going to be talking about? And it became relatively clear that there was no major announcement to be made. It was mostly politics. And guess what? He was also talking about immigration. And basically the crux of the speech was, get a bill on my desk that I can sign. That's basically what the speech was. There was nothing else new there. But remember, President Obama was given primetime speech access on multiple other occasions, as was, the administrations before him. These nationwide speeches go back to Roosevelt. And so, if you've got something huge to say, then the networks are prone to give it to you. But in President Obama's case, he did not get access on that one occasion. But you remember he did get access when they announced the death of Bin Laden. For
sure, yeah.
So it wasn't that there was some blackout. And let's remember too, this isn't a blackout. If you want to hear or see any of these things, there are lots of ways for you to do it. So it's not like the old days when there were three networks and no place to find it on the radio or online or anything.
Everybody, the families huddled around the radio looking at it as if they can see something.
You can get it. There's nothing stopping the free flow of information. I did think it was interesting, and I don't know if this is if this is news to you, but it was news to me when I read it in the New York Times. I just thought it was fascinating that almost exactly at the same time that all of this is going on, so this is the New York Times, January 8th, it was fascinating that in Israel, Netanyahu wanted access to national networks to make a major announcement. Everybody was a little skeptical, got the major announcement, and he assailed the investigation against him, Netanyahu, as a witch hunt. Does this sound familiar? One network in Israel actually pulled the plug in the middle of this speech, 20 minutes. One network actually pulled the plug and said that it was nonsense and they weren't going to keep going with it.
Al, you're challenging my status as a well-read journalist because I missed that one. Hey, yeah, I have...
It was January 8th in the New York Times. I'm looking at it right now. I had no idea. I had not seen it.
Well, I know what I will be reading later on this afternoon. I'm going to ask another question really quick, and then I want to take a question or a comment from a caller. My question is, what does this mean for the state of media covering the presidency going forward? Because let's face it, this president is unprecedented. I mean, there's, what are we up to, like 6,000 documented falsehoods coming from either he or his administration. I mean, people are critical of the media covering every single tweet, every single bombastic statement. Do we need to reevaluate how we as journalists cover the president of the United States when you're dealing with a commander-in-chief like Trump?
Well, I guess I'm always in favor of reconsidering and rethinking, but if the argument is we shouldn't cover every statement of the president, I think we would be in much greater trouble if we said that. If we said, look, the president is so unreliable, we're not going to cover him anymore, I think that'd be an abdication of your duty. That's what you should be doing. That's precisely what you should be doing, whether it's this president or any president. You report what they say, and you try to evaluate and verify what they said. If, for example, you said, let's just rewind the clock a couple of years. Let's say, for example, I'm not going to have any more coverage of the president talking about Mexico paying for the wall. I don't want to hear that anymore. We've heard it. We're not going to report it anymore. It's not new. Well, it turns out it is new. You don't ever know at the time that somebody says something whether or not it's going to be important later. You report it, and you report what the president says, partly because the president of the United States of America makes things happen globally. What they say, what they do, how they act, how they seem, if they're sick, if they're well, where they go, all of those things have ripple effects. And so you report them. And I trust, in the end, and I, like you, I've been doing this a long time. I've been a journalist for 40 years, my 46th year.
Only on year number 9.
Well, but you know what? The older I get, the more I think about something that gives me some comfort, and that is this. If we believe that the public, the people listening to this program, are smart enough to listen to what I'm saying and what you're saying and say, that's nonsense or that's right, that should give us some comfort. If we don't believe that the people have the ability to separate fact from fiction, something they believe and something they don't believe, then we ought to get rid of the jury system and just have a benevolent judge who's lifetime appointed. We ought to get rid of the voting system and just have a king who we like, and forget about it. If we advocate and say, look, we're just not going to be smart enough to figure out right from wrong and good from bad, then forget what we have in America where the people make decisions. It's my experience that people are pretty darn smart, that given enough information, they can sort out what they believe. And I scoff at the pundits and journalists and others who think that we're the only holders of truth, because we're not. We're just not. I think people are much smarter than we give them credit for.
Well,
they
want to
only be smart if we give them enough information.
I have goosebumps because, yes, that's our job. I want to get into the whole fake news thing surrounding this conversation in just a second. But let's hear from Elizabeth in Riverview first. Elizabeth, do you have a question or a comment? What would you like to say?
Well, I have a comment. I am certainly agreeing with your guest. We the people are just not doing our job. This idiot, our president, needs to go. And the only way to get him out of there is, of course, to have Congress shuffle him off. Well, don't the people in Congress understand that if they don't do this, they won't be in Congress anymore? That's what they need to understand, and quickly. This man is going to ruin our country. There is already a national emergency. How many people are unemployed now because of...
Oh, we lost Elizabeth. Okay, sorry about that, Elizabeth, but we hear you. Thank you for your call and your comments. We actually lost Al there for a second, too, but now he's back.
Did I hear Elizabeth say that she's worried that the president is going to ruin the country? Is that what I heard?
That's exactly what you heard.
Well, let me give you my take on that, and that is... I take a longer view of this, and that is to say that in the end, if we want something to change in this country, anything, and again, I don't speak for one party or the other, but what I would say is if we get dissatisfied enough as voters, we will demand change, and by golly, we'll get change. And I would say to you that we still are at a time where a substantial portion of our citizenry do not vote. They don't bother. They don't see enough in it for them. And I wonder whether what Elizabeth said is percolating enough that people say, you know what, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to get involved. I'm going to do everything I can to influence the next election. And I'll be honest with you, I don't see it yet. I don't see the uprising of political activity that equals the amount of outrage I see in media coverage.
So, fake news, right? Like, I mean, as a journalist, you have to have thick skin. I mean, if you're not making people angry, some people, some group of people at any given point, if everyone is pleased with you, you are not doing your job very well. Because, you know, when you're reporting the news, it's going to be bad news for somebody in most cases. What I see is this environment in which when reporters for CNN, and I pick that because Trump particularly hates CNN, but when these reporters who cover the presidency, when they call him out for something being a falsehood or an outright lie, when they, every little fact check, when they point out that he said something that was maybe a little bit silly and made him sound like a fourth grader, whatever it is, they're just fake news. And his base likes that and they believe it. And I see it even as a local reporter when I talk to people and it has nothing to do with national politics and it could be an innocuous topic, you know, to whether or not we should have an extra 3 seconds on a green light or something. And people are like, I'm not going to talk to you because you're the fake news. Should journalists be doing?
I think of information in quadrants. So there's information, which is just raw factual information. There's misinformation, M-I-S, misinformation, which is information that unintentionally got reported wrongly. So instead of 12, it was 24. Instead of 16, it was 32 or whatever. I didn't intend to get it wrong, or they didn't intend to get it wrong, but they did. The most destructive is what I call disinformation, an intentional misstatement in order to mislead you. And that is what I would equate to the phrase fake or a lie, because it's intentional. And I don't like to even hook the words fake news next to each other, because it's almost a contradiction of terms for me. If it's fake, then for me, it's not journalism. It's a lie. If it's disinformation, then I intentionally misled you, or I at least by now should know it's not true when I say it. If there's a record number of people turned out for the inauguration. You know what? No, there wasn't. And by now you should know that. So if you keep saying it, even if you still believe it, it doesn't matter.
What a horse to die on, you know, like crowd then, numbers.
The fourth quadrant, and this is the more difficult one to discern sometimes, is what I call propaganda. And propaganda is sometimes like advertising. Okay, I have the best, the most comfortable, the prettiest, the most stylish. And that's my opinion. Think about political advertising. You know, he's the smartest, he's the best, he's the leader, he's the one who can help you. And the thing about propaganda is that it doesn't have to be ill-intentioned. It can just be one-sided. I'm doing a sales job. So when you think of information in those quadrants, in those four sections, information, misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda, it seems to me that it's on us as consumers to ask, hey, what else is there to know about that? Or, boy, that's kind of seeming one-sided. It doesn't seem like I'm hearing all I need to hear, and so on. And if you're going to be a participant in a democracy, it costs you a little effort. All the people listening here, I mean, just by the nature of this radio station, of your audience, they're activists. They're people who truly care about their community and their country and probably their world. And they're not the normal in the United States. These are people who are truly plugged in and they're active.
Very much so.
But I would say to you, and I suspect your listeners would agree, that's not normal in America.
Right.
And if it was, we would have a very different country. At some point, we'll reach a place where Elizabeth was to say, mm-hmm. I am deeply concerned about this, and I'm going to participate because participating costs me less than not participating.
Well, I tell you what, I think younger people are getting there. And I have kind of a fun anecdote. So, Al, I don't think you and I are friends on Facebook, but yesterday I lamented in an early morning post because I was driving my sophomore, my middle daughter, who's a sophomore in high school, I was driving her to school very early in the morning because they send high schoolers to school way earlier than they should be having to go on, but that's just me.
That's another show.
Yeah, that's another show. And there was a segment that was about the mayoral race, the mayoral debate that just happened here locally this week. And they played just a couple of really short sound bites. They lacked context. And because of the missing context, it was a little bit misleading if you hadn't been there watching the whole debate yourself. And so I explained to my daughter, you know, this is an example of why you need to get your news from multiple sources, because, you know, sometimes when you read, when you get something on a radio, they're confined to the amount of time that they can spend on something. So you're going to miss out on some important information. If you're getting it from a news organization with a particular political bent, they might take a different angle or phrase things in a certain way that make you feel a certain way. And if you take all of those different sources and you combine them, you're able to really, you know, pull together your own idea of what the truth is. And that, to me, is the most important thing that news consumers need to go out into the world with, is not to just operate in a silo and only obtain your information from one or two sources. So anyways,
they're way smarter than I am. and certainly smarter than I was when I was there.
Oh, no, no, no. So the end of that story, and what I was lamenting, was that halfway through my spiel, my daughter looks at me and she's like, "Mom, I don't care." And I'm like, "Well, crap."
Well, so. My kids, one of my daughters is a journalist. My kids are so much more aware than I was at their age. Those of us of a certain age, when the president of the United States said it, it carried a great gravity that you didn't question the way in the post-Nixon age, particularly, I think we questioned. And yeah. I think that's one reason the Pentagon Papers was such a shock. Mm-hmm. The government lied to us? Oh, my goodness. I mean, how could that be? And it was really quite shocking that occurred, mm-hmm. and that we came to realize that. I would say to you that for whatever reasons, awareness or experience or whatever it is, my kids don't look at the news that way. They there's got to be another angle.
Yep.
There's something else going on.
My kids are definitely getting there. I imagine my daughter didn't need the spiel, and that's why she cut me off and told me she didn't give
a
crap.
Well, you're giving a spiel, and that's the other thing I would pitch, is that every person here shouldn't take the story you just give and say, "Oh, well, I'm not going to bother talking to my kids about it."
Exactly. They hear it. Whether, even if she shuts me out, even if she rolls her eyes and tells me to shut up and I'm stupid, at some point in her life, she's going to remember that conversation.
Absolutely.
And that's what matters. So I want to, we're almost out of time. I want to read a couple of emails that came in while we've been chatting. And this one is really, really funny. It says, "Here's how every media outlet can cover Trump." Quote, "In other news, the president lied about some more stuff today. Now sports." I thought that was really funny. Kudos to you, whoever sent that email.
It's funny reading and
but it's not reality.
But it's an abdication of our duty, and you wouldn't really want
exactly.
to do it.
But it is a funny joke, and you know, maybe like an SNL soundbite. Another emailer suggested maybe presidential addresses can be run on a delay so that there's at least some level of fact checking that happens in real time as people are seeing it. Have you heard that thrown out as a solution?
I actually have, and what I would say to you is, I believe that you're smart enough to know that this is coming to you live. This person is saying whatever it is they want to say, which is sort of the beauty of the democracy, is that we're not going to keep you from what's going on. But know this, that when it's over with, we're going to go backwards and try to figure out what was said that was reliable and what was said that was unreliable.
Sure thing. All right, let's take a call really quick, and then I got to sign it off to the next show. Daryl in Tampa, give me 15 seconds.
Great. To Miss Elizabeth, I feel the same way, and I've said it before, too. The reason why a lot of people aren't so much activists is because they ain't feeling it yet. So after this shutdown, I think a lot of people are going to feel the residual effects of it, and you're going to see activism.
Amen.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yep. Thank you very much, Daryl. Appreciate your brevity. All right, Al, we've got about a minute left here, so I'm going to give me like a 30-second close-off here.
We have,
don't take your clothes off. That's not what I meant. Good
we
Lord.
We have the luxury of living in a democracy. We have the responsibility of participating. And part of that means being a good citizen, being well-informed, listening to opinions that you don't agree with and try to understand them. Don't just argue, but try to understand why are they coming from that point of view and why do they feel that way and what do I need to know about that, and then evaluate it. We're going to survive whatever conflict is going on right now. We're going to get through it. We're going to get through it stronger than we came into it. But democracies are messy business. And if you like order, you don't like democracy.
So many words of wisdom from you, Al. I always enjoy listening to you talk. And as a young journalist, it's really nice to have somebody to look up to and learn from. And hopefully this next generation like me will come up and fill your shoes and keep it going.
Well, God bless these listeners. This is a wonderful, wonderful audience that cares.
All right. Thank you so much, Al, for your time today. I really appreciate it. You have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, so thank you so much for tuning in today for a couple of very important conversations, I think. Transportation locally, and then, of course, the government shutdown and all things Trump, all things that are very near and dear to all of our hearts and important things to discuss. I'm going to hand it over to Joellen for some art in your ear. I'm sure she has something fabulous queued up for you over there. I will be back here, same time, same place, next week from all of us here at WMNF Tampa. Happy Friday.